he tells himself. If this is meant to be, then I'll be able to get in. While his gut tells him Fisher Pitt is probably the basis of her code, he doubts she used a name that could be easily found on a map of the surrounding area. So he goes for the year it closed, and adds it to his previous string of digits, 1986474. A single beep. Access granted. The flood of adrenaline makes him dizzy at first, then breathless with elation. He almost forgets to follow the Savior's next instruction, which is to pass the code along if he cracks it. He has, and he does. He's proud of how it looks on the burner phone's screen, next to all the nervous preparatory texts they've exchanged over the past few hours. A task completed. A goal met. In another few seconds, he's crossed the courtyard and slipped inside the house. She's left the air conditioning on, a necessity even in October, and the cool air kisses his skin in an undeniably welcoming way. He's in. And just as he expected, a few minutes later, the locks all click shut behind him, the sounds a confirmation of his speed and smarts. Not just that, but his destiny as well. Their destiny. Now he just needs to find her guns. 4.
Describe them to me, Dylan says.
I can't. The dreams are too vague, Charlotte answers.
Can you remember any of them?
Not really. It's more like I wake up with an awareness that they were bad. Or that I was being chased.
Dreams are funny things.
These dreams aren't funny. I mean, I don't wake up laughing.
Figure of speech,
he says.
Forgive me. What I mean is that most neuroscientists believe dreams don't actually have a chronology when we're in them. When we're asleep, we are not tuned into the type of physical stimuli our bodies use to detect the passage of time.
So what does that mean? She asks.
It means our brains have been firing a stream of random images at us, and our waking minds instinctively place them in a coherent order, a narrative that makes sense to us.
So dreams have less to do with our subconscious and more to do with our mental state when we wake up? Is that what you're trying to say?
Actually, I'm trying to get you to describe your dreams over the past 2 weeks.
I can barely remember them. I just wake up sweating and with a sense of anxiety and dread, like someone's in the house with me.
Is Jason Briffle in them?
She shoots him dagger eyes before she can stop herself. He shakes his head.
Sorry. Your stalker, is he in any of the...
Like I said, they're vague. They're more like... I don't know. Swirls of feelings.
Swirls of feelings. That's an interesting description.
Is it?
What about the other agreements that you've made with yourself? How have those gone?
Other agreements?
The mask maker. It was very upsetting when you first read about it. We'd agreed you'd make an effort to avoid anything further about the case.
Have they found another body? She asks.
I feel like this is your way of maybe answering my question.
Because if I'd broken my agreement, I'd know whether or not they'd found another body.
She smiles.
He smiles back.
So maybe you're answering my question. Or maybe you're using me to get around the agreement you made with yourself.
He smiles again. She smiles back. Does that mean you're not going to tell me?
Well, if you remember correctly, they didn't find a body. They found a face.
I remember. And if they haven't found another one, then it's not a serial.
That's not what you felt when you first read about it. You thought the gruesomeness of the crime, the fact that the face was displayed in public like some kind of mask, meant...
Maybe it's a mafia hit. Isn't there a lot of Russian mafia in L.A.?
The police don't seem to think so. That it's a hit or that there's a lot of Russian mafia in L.A.
Charlie, we're off the point.
There's a point?
There hasn't been a high-profile serial predator like this in a while.
You mean a good reason for me to avoid all news everywhere?
Pretty much, yes.
So they did find another face.
I'm not answering that.
Why not?
Because it's not the point.
Again, what is the point, Dylan?
He bows his head, closes his mouth as if he's reconsidering his initial response.
For a long while, there's just silence and the low murmur of the AA meeting downstairs. Occasionally, a motorcycle backfires in the street below, probably snarled in the little knot of traffic that always develops around that crosswalk they just installed between the movie theater and the new ice cream parlor next door to the center.
So it's not the movie, she says, trying to control her anger.
It's that I'm not over those letters from
my stalker.
It's this mask maker psycho. I mean, I don't understand what you're trying to say.
I'm saying it's all of them.
I'm saying the number of potential triggers in your life is expanding by the day, and it's expanding because you're on too fragile a foundation. You live in isolation, you have no meaningful friendships.
That's not true, I have Kayla.
I'm not including the lawyer who helped you sue your father. That's a business relationship.
And she lives in San Francisco.
We talk once a week.
You've got all your grandmother's friends back in Altamira, and you've been to visit them how many times?
That one's hard.
Why?
Because my grandmother's still dead.
She's still dead whether you visit her friends or not.
Jesus, Dylan.
You need a breath, Charlotte.
Well, I'm not gonna get it talking to you right now. And what happened to the bridge? I thought I needed a bridge. What, are we building a whole city here?
You need something that's going to reduce your anxiety levels so that you can start acting contrary to your instincts right now.
And what are my instincts right now?
To isolate, self-obsess, and convince yourself of things about yourself that aren't true.
Ouch.
I've been seeing you for months now, so I'm gonna say this with confidence. Unless you initiate a small-scale change in your brain chemistry, you'll remain incapable of developing the kind of healthy behavioral patterns that will get you out of this place you're stuck in.
I love my house.
You live in a ghost town full of snakes.
People are stupid about snakes. And ghosts.
Maybe so, but neither make very good friends.
It's beautiful out there. Especially the stars. At night, I mean. They're incredible.
I wouldn't know.
Maybe I'll ask you to drop by sometime.
I doubt it.
Is that a no?
Does it matter? You'll never ask.
Sorry.
You're not.
Why is he smiling? Shouldn't he be pissed? She just stares at him.
You're not sorry, Charlie, and that's a good thing. You want to know why?
Because it means you're a fighter.
If I'm a fighter, then how come I can't leave my house? We've covered this. You can leave, you just don't want to. And the more you give in to that urge, the more you'll come to believe the lies you're telling yourself about what you are and aren't capable of. It's a cycle, Charlie. It's a self-reinforcing cycle of mistaken thinking, and we have to come up with a way for you to break it once and for all.
Even if it involves pills, she thinks. Maybe if she weren't so damn tired, this would be it, the moment she stormed out of his office and never came back. But she is tired. So tired, she wasn't sure she was in shape to make the drive to town. A drive that's practically a straight shot across open desert on a flat two-lane blacktop. He's mentioned drugs at least once a session. In the beginning, she'd figured this was just his way of reminding her that he's an actual psychiatrist who can prescribe stuff. that he isn't just some touchy-feely psychologist with a degree he earned online. But he's never let up on it. And he hasn't now, even though she told him how her father tried to medicate her into silence when she was 10. And she's tired. She likes these sessions. She needs them. And the sense that he's getting impatient with her, it's affecting her more than she wants it to. Maybe more than she thinks it should. Or I'm feeling worn down because he's right, she considers. Not just because he went to Harvard or because he looks like all the actors who've ever played Superman run together. What's that AA saying she's always liked? Keep it simple, stupid. And so what's the simplest question and the simplest answer here? Do I need sleep? Yes. Hell yes. Dear God, yes. What do you have in mind? She hears herself say. Some kind of sleeping pill? He lowers his right leg from where he's braced the ankle on top of his left knee, setting aside the legal pad on which he's not taken a single note since they started. No, he answers. Not a sleeping pill. He gets to his feet, turns to his desk, and opens the drawer. She expects him to pull out a prescription pad. Instead, he removes a square of white cardboard. 6 bright orange pills encased inside little plastic bubbles. What is that? It's called Zyprexin. He takes a seat on the edge of his chair and holds the pill packet in between his thumb and forefinger. He's gazing into her eyes now, the talk therapist replaced by the medical doctor. And I think it's going to be just perfect for you. 5. The first gun is under the sink. A Beretta M9 in a holster attached to the cabinet ceiling, within easy reach of anyone doing dishes or moving about the compact, tidy kitchen. Jason slides his backpack off one shoulder and digs out the plastic bags. He removes the gun's magazine and strips it with one hand, punching the bullets one after the other into the Ziploc he holds open with his other hand. Once the magazine is empty, he seals the bag and drops it inside his backpack. Then he inspects the chamber to make sure he didn't leave a bullet sitting inside. He inserts the empty magazine and returns the gun to its hidden holster. Dark is falling. He needs to work quickly. But the temptation to study his surroundings is almost overwhelming. The house has 2 bedrooms along a short, narrow, tiled hallway. At the end of the hallway is the door to the small garage. Both bedrooms have only a thin band of clerestory windows, probably to protect them from the heat. The bulletproof glass they are made of doesn't have anything to do with the temperature outside. The living room has a wall of floor-to-ceiling windows that look out onto the small courtyard. The glass here is also bulletproof. And he's willing to bet it replaced what was once a sliding glass door. Now the only entrance to the courtyard is the house's front door. It's the lawsuit against her father that financed this place. He's sure of this. The lawsuit was the last time she'd appeared in the press. Jason kept all the clippings. In the last interview Trina ever gave, she'd asserted she was asking for only enough money to start a new life for herself, something that didn't involve profiting off the memories of the Bannings' victims. The message boards devoted to her and the killings had exploded with rage. She was a liar who didn't give a whit about the victims, they'd claimed, and her lawsuit was just another form of self-promotion. Under a string of aliases, Jason had tried to defend her. To blame Lowell Pierce for caring only about money and filling her head with junk science and never allowing her to tell her own story. But the other posters assailed him. They claimed his statements implied a personal relationship with Trina he couldn't prove. And when he told them he would prove them all wrong someday, they'd banned him for violating some policy around threats that wasn't in the forum's guidelines. He could barely bring himself to care.
He wasn't like the rest of them. They pretended to weep for the victims so they could pore over the crime scene photos. They pretended to hate the Bannings because, like him, they aspired to their purity and greatness. They just couldn't admit it. And now he's here, inside her house. So fuck those hypocrites. He's hard-pressed to call the front room a living room, because it looks more like a comfortable office than a place to relax. The desk and giant computer monitors, three of them, all widescreen, fanned out across an L-shaped desk so that they almost surround whoever's sitting at it, look like Hollywood's idea of a NASA workstation. Her desk chair is coated in worn but soft-looking padding that suggests she spends more time there than anywhere else around the house. It's the bedrooms that are calling to him. But what's the sense in going through her belongings if he's going to burn them all anyway? She's going to burn them, he corrects himself, once he manages to convince her of their future together. Because by then she'll get it. By then they'll have had plenty of time out here alone together without the distractions of crowds, birth fathers, or restraining orders. But for now, he's got the other guns to empty. One down, two to go. 6. She stood up the minute Dylan handed her the pill. It was a reflexive move on her part, and she's not sure why she did it. Seconds before, Dylan had been leaning toward her, through the several feet of space between his chair and hers. Maybe their proximity became too much for her, or maybe now that she has the pill in hand, she wants to run from the office and swallow it in private before she loses her nerve. At any rate, the fact that she's now on her feet has left Dylan staring up at her awkwardly. Worse, it suggests she wants to end this meeting when the truth is quite the opposite. The bright orange pill burns a hole in her palm, it seems, and she's full of questions about it.
A what? She asks. It's a derivative of a benzodiazepine.
What's that, an antidepressant?
No. It's a very mild central nervous system depressant. It's designed to be fast-acting, but it's also timed release, so it should remain relatively constant in your bloodstream for the next 24 hours. I want you to come back around this time tomorrow so we can assess.
Assess what?
How you respond to the drug. We can pull you off it right away if you don't like the side effects.
Okay. And the positive effects are supposed to be what exactly?
A rapid reduction in anxiety and fear-based thinking without the sedation effects of a heavier benzo or Valium. Doesn't sound like you're suffering from clinical insomnia, just a sleep disruption caused by conditional anxiety. This will attack the anxiety directly, but in a measured and hopefully consistent way.
It's new?
Excuse me?
This drug's Zyprexin,
yes. It's brand new, actually. They're just rolling it out now. I've got enough samples for us to have a little trial run before you decide if a prescription will work for you.
Okay. When should I take it?
Now.
Now? I need to be able to drive home.
It shouldn't impair your ability to drive or work or anything like that. A lot of central nervous system depressants, Xanax and others, produce a single, powerful, tranquilizing effect that becomes addictive. Zyprexin is designed to attack persistent anxiety at a lower dose, released consistently throughout the day.
She's staring at the pill, and she still hasn't been able to force herself to sit.
Look, Charlie, there's stronger stuff out there we can talk about. This is not a wonder cure by any stretch, but I think it's well suited for you.
And you want me to take it right now? She asks.
To be frank, that doesn't sound like a question for me.
Is he losing patience with her? Will he stop seeing her if she doesn't take the pill? Is she doing exactly what he just accused her of doing by asking herself these questions,
pretending the real issue is how someone else perceives her and not what she needs for herself. After all she's been through, why is this so scary? It's a pill, and she can be pulled off it at any time. And while she's certainly no expert in antidepressants or central nervous system depressants or whatever other class of drugs they give people to stabilize their moods these days, it sounds pretty mild. And it's him. Dylan. Dr. Thorpe, when he's asked her to do something she doesn't want to do. How many hours have they spent together in this tiny office, talking about her and only her? Too many to count offhand, that's for sure. And he's listened to her the way no one else has since her grandmother died. More important, he's told her the truth about herself, even when it might sound unkind. Only a few people have done that for her before. Her grandmother, now gone, and her grandmother's boyfriend, Marty, whom she can barely bring herself to call these days because the sound of his voice brings back a flood of once joyful memories. Water, she hears herself say. Dylan reaches for an unopened bottle of water on his desk. He uncaps it for her. One swig and she's swallowed the pill. That took strength, Charlie, he says, rising slowly to his feet. His hands grip her shoulders. It's the most intimate touch they've ever shared. Making a new decision, breaking an old habit? It takes strength. And believe me, he kisses her gently on the forehead. You are stronger than you know. It's the first time she's been touched, the first time she's been kissed in even a quick and chaste way, in years, and it makes her dizzy. She wants to cry again, but she can't blame the pill. No way could it have gone to work this fast. She can blame her sleeplessness, for sure. While she's at it, she can also stop searching Dylan's face for some evidence that the kiss was more than just a doctor getting carried away by enthusiasm. Dylan makes that easier for her when he turns to his desk and picks up a small notebook. For the next 24 hours, I want you to keep a log of everything you go through. Anything that feels strange or off. Anything that might be a side effect. Write it down in this. He taps the notebook, then presses it into her hand. He opens the office door and steers her through it. After the sudden, unexplained kiss, the feel of his hand against the small of her back makes her skin tingle. Then I want to see you back here same time tomorrow, so we can assess. By the time she's reached the foot of the stairs, Dylan's closed his office door again, which makes her feel unmoored and adrift. The AA meeting will break up soon, and if she lingers here, some of the regulars might ask a bunch of prying questions about why she stopped attending. She steps outside into the evening dark. She hurries to her car, reminds herself with each step of Dylan's promise that whatever this damn drug is, it won't affect her ability to drive home. Only once she's behind the wheel does it sink in that there's a strange new substance in her body. And for a second, she feels as if she's been violated. My choice, she reminds herself. It will be different this time because it was my choice. She repeats these words in her head like a mantra, as Scarlet shrinks in her rearview mirror. 7. When the motorcycle almost runs her off the road, Charlotte's tempted to blame the medication. How else could she have missed its approach? It's got no mufflers. The roar that swallows her Ford Escape now sends pure, raw fear shooting through her from head to toe. For a second, she's blinded by its headlight. Then it swings to the left before swerving in front of her SUV. All right, Zepraxin. Do your thing. Two more motorcycles appear on either side of her. Her heart races. Her palms are so sweaty she fears they might slip from the steering wheel if she doesn't hold on for dear life. What the hell is this? She's seen these guys before, mostly pulling in and out of the old bus sheds they've turned into their unincorporated hangout. It's where they're all headed now, she assumes. She hopes. But they've never tried to overtake her on the road like this. Was she weaving? Is this their way of punishing her? Fencing her in, drowning her in horrible sound? Staring straight ahead seems like the best plan, but there's almost nothing for her to stare at. Except desert dark, and the biker in the lead. At least the guy in front is allowing more distance now between the tail of his bike and the nose of her SUV. There's faint purple in the western sky, but it's mostly dark out now. In fact, there aren't even lights to mark the spot where she knows their hideout stands. And that's bad, she thinks. That means the place isn't just a hideout. It's some kind of storehouse, and they don't want anyone to know about it. Up until a few weeks ago, she was alone out here, which is exactly how she likes it. When the bikers first showed up, she hadn't given them a second thought. Criminals who just want to do their own thing. A change of pace from the monsters in her past. Let them cook or deal their meth in peace, she'd thought. She wants to be left alone, and so do they. But now they're taking an interest in her. A really loud, scary interest. And up close she can see the telltale signs of hardcore outlaws. A guy named Benny used to come to the meetings at the center all the time and share about his Hell's Angels past. The other alcoholics got tired of him after a while, maybe because his shares had less to do with recovery than bragging about his criminal cred. But Charlotte was riveted every time he spoke. And now, thanks to Benny, she knows the sleeveless denim shirts these guys are wearing are called cuts. The patches on the back are signs they're full-fledged members of the gang in question. The word Vapados fills the center patch on each guy's back. She's not sure what it means. Is it the name of their biker gang? Benny's shares always made it sound as if Arizona belonged to the Hell's Angels. So where did these guys come from? Only a few more minutes until they'd pass their hideout. If they still had her fenced in by then, it might be time to take the Beretta out of the glove compartment. But what good would that do? Charlotte puts in several hours a week of practice on the thing, but she's never tried getting off a good shot at 65 miles an hour. If they work together, the bikers could run her off the road before she manages to fire. Then where would she be? They're close to their hangout now. Close enough that she might have to make a decision in the next minute. She looks to one side. Sure enough, the biker to her left is staring at her. His helmet, yellow-tinted glasses, and wind-rippling beard steal most of the definition from his face. But he's big. Thor big. He stares at her with a leisurely confidence. When she sees the tattoo of a pistol on the side of his neck, and the sleeves of ornate carnage inked down his arms, her spine feels like piano keys being walked on by a cat. Fuck, she whispers. He smiles. He's read her lips, and he's amused. Then he aims a trigger finger in her direction and peels away suddenly. His buddies follow suit. Their headlights bounce across the roadside and briefly illuminate the old sheds they've made their own. She welcomes the darkness that closes in all around her now, even though the absence of the deafening motorcycles leaves her with the haggard sound of her own breathing. At least she's got her first journal entry. 30 minutes after initial dose, biker gang manages to scare ever-living shit out of me. Got anything stronger, Dylan? Should she kill her headlights when she gets close to her house? Or do they already know she lives out here? Maybe that's why they were slowing down and checking her out. But the message of that trigger finger was clear. Don't come back. She sometimes goes 2 weeks without leaving the house. That must be why it took them a while to pick up on the fact that she's passed them more than once today. There's got to be some way to send a message that she could give two shits what they're doing in those sheds.
or what they're hiding. Maybe if they knew I was Burning Girl. Just thinking the nickname turns her stomach. Or maybe that's the after effect of almost being run off the road. Or maybe it's the Zyprexin. Or maybe, and this thought makes her dizzy as well as nauseated, it's the realization that she barely noticed the biker's approach because she was still thinking about Dylan's kiss. Dylan's quick, but somehow furtive and totally inappropriate kiss. She hates that she let her guard down on a mostly empty road because she was obsessing over her psychiatrist like some love-struck teenager. But that's not quite it, she realizes. Yes, there had been a moment right when his lips touched her skin when she'd felt something open inside her. Some hunger for intimate connection she'd assumed she'd locked away. It was instinctive, this response. But now, with a little distance between her and the center, it wasn't just the kiss that bothered her. It was the way he'd touched her after. The way he'd guided her out of his office, one hand against the small of her back. As if, because she'd finally broken down and consented to taking the pill, he now saw her as firmly under his control. Touchy, confident, yet strangely hurried. An odd combination of words to describe his behavior, but an accurate one. And one she never would have applied to him before. "You're overthinking this," she tells herself. "You're feeling guilty and weak because you took the pill, and now you're reading too much into his behavior." Behavior that included a kiss. She drives past her own house. Maybe that's for the best. If the bikers are following her, which she doubts, this gives her a chance to kill her headlights and double back. She's made her way from the edge of the highway to her place in the dark plenty of times when she thought someone might be trailing her. Once her eyes adjust, it's fairly easy. The line of mountains on the distant horizon is jagged enough that it's often discernible even against the night sky, especially when there's still a faint fringe of purple as there is now. When the shadow of her house rises up out of the desert floor, she hits the garage door opener attached to her keyring. The light comes on inside, and she uses its bright glow to guide herself the rest of the way in. The garage isn't covered by the security system, but any attempt to break in through the metal door would be more than visible in her headlights. Still, the minute it takes to get from her car to the alarm keypad next to the back door always leaves her feeling exposed. Her escape crosses the threshold. She turns on the headlights and hits the key fob. The garage door begins to descend. Before stepping out, she scans the cement floors just to make sure no desert critters followed her in. She's had enough contact with rattlers to know they just want to be left the hell alone. Unless you step on them. If you step on them, you're screwed. If there's one inside the garage with her, it's because the tires dragged it in by mistake. In which case, it's probably dying, or in pieces. There's nothing in the garage with her. Just the ticking sounds of her cooling vehicle and the rattle and whine of the steel door descending behind her. She's home. Safe. And man, does she have to pee. It's either a result of her brush with the Sons of Anarchy or a side effect of the medication. There's a half bath right before the main hallway's entrance to the kitchen. As soon as she sits down on the toilet, she realizes something feels wrong. It's her pants. Their weight seems off. Something's missing from the pockets. Her phone. She hasn't carried a purse in years, and she rarely visits town in anything other than blue jeans, so she usually tucks her phone in her front pocket to avoid sitting on it. But it's not there. Her jeans feel light, and they slid too easily over her knees. Did she leave it in the car? She can't remember having it since she wandered into Dylan's office. She must have put it down on his desk. When she'd thought she heard it during their session, Dylan had told her the noise came from his, and she needed to focus. She's not sure how to describe what she hears next. creak isn't right. But it's too half-hearted to be a footstep.
Movement. There is movement somewhere inside her house, just outside the bathroom door she didn't bother to lock.
And I don't have my phone, she thinks.
The same phone that would display an alert if someone messed with my alarm or, God forbid, managed to turn it off while I was gone.
Miraculously, she manages to finish peeing. But when she reaches for the toilet paper, her hand is shaking. It feels as if a ghost has closed its fingers around the back of her neck.
And she realizes that while she lives in a state of perpetual anxiety and sometimes flat-out dread, it's been a long time since she has been truly afraid. Not just afraid, terrified. And it's physical, this feeling, a series of pulses traveling through her body, like she can feel her heartbeat in her hands and feet.
The sound repeats,
and the silence on either end of it is unmistakable, a silence that suggests restraint,
human restraint,
an effort to stay as quiet as possible.
One of the bikers? Impossible.
Even if they'd killed their headlights, there's no way they could have followed her into the garage without her seeing them or hearing them.
But these sounds, they're coming from the direction of the garage. Or one of the bedrooms between the bathroom and the garage. Both her arms are tingling the same way her leg does when it goes to sleep. And yet, some instinct is kicking in.
Some instinct that tells her it's best to pretend she hasn't heard anything. Best to act as if nothing's amiss. Then, as if she's about to begin preparing dinner, she'll make a beeline for the kitchen and the gun under the sink.
Everything is fine, she tells herself as she washes her hands. Her trembling hands.
She's had physical responses to fear before, but never this strong. The tingling in her arms is almost painful now. Her hands shake as if there's some disturbance inside the bones of her wrists.
Everything is fine, she tells herself again.
She opens the bathroom door, head bowed as if she has no urge at all to look in either direction, as if all she wants to do is stroll into the kitchen and fix herself something to eat.
Everything is not fine.
But you're going to pretend it is until you can put a bullet in this bastard. Then things will be fine again.
It takes all the effort she has, but she forces herself to go to the fridge and take out a Diet Coke.
Because women who are afraid they're about to be murdered don't get themselves a Diet Coke.
They don't stand over the sink, taking a leisurely sip of their favorite soft drink while secretly gauging how many seconds it will take to pull their Beretta from under the cabinet at their legs. And this charade, she hopes, will give her an element of surprise. She hears the footsteps behind her only because she's listening for them. They're soft enough that she would have missed them otherwise. And then she realizes she's made a critical mistake. She forgot to turn on the light in the kitchen,
and now she's standing in almost total darkness over the sink, which looks about as natural as if she'd just hit the linoleum in a downward dog.
In the window above the sink, she sees his shadow. She sees his curls, just their silhouette, backlit by the garage light. Jason Briffle's curls. Her hands have stopped shaking, but the tingling has moved from her arms, across her back, and up the back of her neck. It's even touching the sides of her face. One shot, she tells herself. Shoot him and make a break for the living room and the front door. No talk, no negotiation. He's in my fucking house. If he wants to die here, he made that choice when he broke in. I moved to a stand-your-ground state for a reason.
She imagines herself doing it before she's done it. Imagines pulling the gun from the holster attached to the cabinet ceiling, turning and firing off as many shots as it takes to drop him.
She imagines it so clearly she doesn't realize she's just tried it. And nothing happened.
She's pulled the trigger twice, and the only sounds in the kitchen are their combined breaths. Jason has raised his hands, not in surrender, but to calm her. He approaches her slowly, as if she's a hysterical woman, and he's broken into her house in the middle of nowhere because he's the only one in the universe who can reason with her. How, she thinks, the word like a mad bird's cawing in her brain. How did he get here? How did he get in my house? Her new name's not even on the deed. Kayla helped her set up a trust after they won the case against her dad. No one else knows she's out here. No one, except...
Put the gun down, Trina.
That's not my name.
It is your name. It will always be your name. Now enough of this game playing, enough of the denial. We're grown-ups now, and it's time for us to talk about grown-up things.
From the back waistband of his pants, he pulls a gun. One of her guns. No doubt this one's fully loaded. It's the one from her bedroom or under her desk in the living room. It has to be. But he keeps it pointed at the ceiling. The gesture says he doesn't want to use it on her, but he will if he has to, which seems as sick and condescending as the words he just spoke with oily certainty.
You need to leave, she hears herself say.
You need to leave my house.
This isn't a house, Trina. This is a shack, a prison. I hate to sound so judgmental, but it's pathetic. I mean, you're out here in the middle of nowhere. It's not safe.
She wants to believe he's taunting her, but he isn't. He genuinely believes the things he's saying, and he's lost a considerable amount of weight. That fact terrifies her almost as much as his presence here. When she last saw him, there was something infant-like about his portliness. Now he's lean and ready to pounce, and this suggests he's been preparing for this moment, transforming himself into a more efficient predator. He aspires to be a serial killer. She's known this from the moment she read his letters. But his behavior has always been more stalker than murderer. Can she appeal to the former side of him? Can she soothe and seduce him? You scared me, Jason.
The things you did?
They scared me. Feed his ego. Make him feel as if he's the center of my world.
Well, that's ridiculous, Trina, he says, with a great, pained smile that almost looks like a grimace. I'd never hurt you.
Then why are you here?
To bring you back, he says. To bring you back to your life. Your real life. Your destiny.
With you, she says. She tries to keep her voice as neutral as she can, to not betray her disgust at these words, and apparently she's successful because he nods fiercely as he takes another step toward her.
You made the first step yourself, and that's good. You cut yourself off from your birth father and got him out of your life, and that was the best thing you could have done.
And then,
well, the universe stepped in and handled the rest.
The rest?
Your grandmother.
What about my grandmother? A mistake to ask this. There's a tremor in her voice now.
It was for the best. She was in your way, too. I know you were sad when she died, but it was the only way for you to be free.
Did you hurt my grandmother, Jason?
No,
he whines. He sounds like a child. And he's so genuinely wounded, she knows he's telling the truth.
I can't cause heart attacks. I'm not God. But if there is a God, he took her away when he did because she wasn't your real family, Trina. Abigail is. I am.
She runs for it. There's a few feet of space between the sink and the door to the living room. As soon as she bounds in that direction, she hears him erupt.
No, 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 no,
he says, like a man whose dog has just jumped from the back seat of his car. He He crashes into her from behind, arms around her waist suddenly. He still holds the gun in one hand, which is stupid. Stupid and untrained. The two of them careen into her desk, and at any moment he could fire wildly by accident. Her head slams into one of the computer monitors, then the solid wall behind it. She feels no pain. None of the bone-rattling, stomach-churning agony that should follow such a double blow. It's shock. It has to be. But even as she tumbles amid the wreckage of her deck, the tingling she felt earlier is all over her body, along with another sensation. It's utterly foreign, utterly without precedent, in her experience. The words that leap to her mind to describe it are just as strange. Bone music. It feels like the bass line of some song is being played inside her very bones. The desk gives way beneath them as they struggle. Her arms flail. She feels her fingers close around the stand of one of the widescreen monitors as it falls along with her. What happens next takes place with the very ease, grace, and speed with which she tried to shoot him moments ago. She is standing now, facing the living room, and Jason is on his knees. Somehow she is holding one of the widescreen monitors in one hand. The same monitor it took both hands to get out of the box when she first installed it. The same monitor that was so top-heavy she was afraid of dropping the thing before she managed to lower it to her desk for the first time. Now she's holding it in one hand, her fingers gripping the open O in its A-shaped stand, as if the whole thing weighs no more than a fly swatter. And that's exactly how she's just used the thing on Jason's head. Jason sways back and forth, his eyes wide and unblinking. Blood spurts from his right temple. In another second, he'll be spitting it from his lips. Or drinking it, because his jaw is slack and the way he's swaying looks like he can't tell up from down, as if he might keel over at any moment. "Don't get up," she says. He doesn't listen. He throws one leg out in front of him, knee bent, foot steady on the floor. So she hits him again. This time she's fully present while she does it. The miracle of it leaves her in a daze. It truly feels as if the monitor weighs almost nothing. Its impact with his skull causes only the slightest recoil in her arm. To accomplish all of this, she needed only a few short breaths. And now that she's done it, she needs only a few more, and then she feels fully recovered. And she's still holding the thing in one hand like it's a costume shield. This is impossible, she thinks. But how else can she explain the fact that Jason Briffle is now sprawled on his back, looking as if he's just been dropped from a great height? He doesn't even stir as she picks up the gun he dropped, keeping it aimed at him as she grabs for the nearest phone, the one that wasn't pulled to the floor by their collision with her desk. Her landline is hooked up to a satellite internet connection, and he's cut the line between the base and the wall. Cell phone service out here is passable, thanks to the 3 signal boosters she installed on the roof. But her phone's probably back at Dylan's office, if she didn't leave it in the car. And Jason might not be alone. Gun raised, she cases each room, the way she taught herself to do after watching countless YouTube videos posted by retired cops. She's never been so grateful to have such a small house with so few hiding places. In her bedroom closet, she finds his backpack. But when she reaches for it with one hand, it seems to take flight into the air behind her. Adrenaline, she tells herself. Just adrenaline. It won't last. But the tingling's still there. The bone music is still there. And there's no denying that by reaching for the bag with what she thought was a minimal amount of effort, she'd somehow ended up throwing it into the air behind her. Breathe, she tells herself. Shrink. She almost laughs at this second command, but that's exactly what she has to do. Whatever crazy hormonal event is taking place inside her system, the only way she can think to counteract it so she can function normally is to shrink every action, her every move. She bends down. Gently gripping the zipper's pull between a thumb and forefinger, she slowly and carefully opens the bag. And even with all that deliberate restraint, the bag ends up opening like some horny dude's jeans. When she sees the rope, and the rolls of duct tape and the Ziploc bags full of her bullets, all thoughts of shrinking are forgotten. Jason's still dead to the world when she returns to the living room. He might actually be dead, but she doesn't give a shit. The only thing that matters to her is that he stays exactly where he is so she can bring the cops back here and show them how he broke in, how he violated her space. She'll tell them everything. She's got nothing to hide. By then, this crazy adrenaline rush will have subsided, she's sure. He can't get away. That's all that matters to her now. No way will she let him slip away into the shadows so he can lie in wait for the right moment to shatter her sanity and sense of safety again. First, she wraps his head in tape, making a muzzle across his mouth. Then she binds his wrists, his ankles. When she starts binding his ankles to his wrists, she realizes she's hog-tying him, just like Daniel and Abigail used to bind their victims. But she banishes the thought before it can take hold. She's trying not to beat him up, but she still can't control her own strength entirely. Her tugs and pulls knock his head against the floor with sickening whacks. Gun drawn, she backs out of the living room. I'll be right back, fucker. Amazing, the confidence with which she's issued this proclamation, the steadiness. Like her voice has recognized the magnitude of her newfound strength, even as her mind refuses. With the lightest touch she can manage, she hits a button on her key fob and opens the trunk of her escape. With just as much care and restraint, she roots through the plastic bags from the office supply store. No sign of her phone. Carefully, so as not to pull it off its hinges, she opens the door to the back seat, scans the floor. No sign there either. She slides behind the wheel like someone easing into frigid water. She places the gun in the cup holder, barrel down, within easy reach, positioned to aim right through the windshield if she needs it to. Ever so slowly, she reaches for the glove compartment, pops it open with three times less effort than she might ordinarily use. The phone's not there, either, which means it has to be in Dylan's office. Which means she's got to drive to the nearest police station herself. Just then, she realizes there's one place she hasn't checked for accomplices. Outside. She hits the key fob. The garage door starts to open. Gun raised, she approaches the growing square of dark. It takes a few minutes for her eyes to adjust. By then, she swept the opening. By then, she can see there are no lurking shadows of cars hiding with their headlights turned off. The ground is flat. The nearest hiding place is an arroyo a good 15-minute walk away, the same place she does target practice with the Berettas. Besides, Jason has always worked alone. Jason has always wanted her all to himself. But how did he get my code? She's got no time to speculate. She's confirmed that there are no vehicles waiting to ram her as soon as she leaves the garage, and that means she's free to go. As she slides behind the wheel of her escape and places her Beretta back in the cup holder, she sees that her fingers have left indentations in the metal handle of her gun. Not just adrenaline, she thinks. This can't be just adrenaline. 8. The bikers roar out of the darkness, headlights winking on the minute their tires hit the road. When Charlotte first met up with the highway, she went to give the pedal the usual amount of pressure and ended up marrying it to the floor, which sent the escape rocketing through the night at more than 100 miles an hour. She's been soft-pedaling it since then. It's kept the escape close to 80. That's what she's doing now as they cage her in. I've been waiting for her, she realizes, maybe since they heard her approach. No doubt her third trip past their hideout in one day has them convinced she's casing the place. Thor's next to her again, gesturing for her to pull over. Her refusal to comply causes his mouth to contort into a snarl. The sight of his anger awakens something in her, a recognition that she's been impossibly changed. And not changed like that guy, possibly an urban legend, who was able to lift a car in one hand to free an accident victim pinned beneath it. This is ongoing, whatever this is. It's sustained. My body knows it. My mind's starting to accept it. And that's why Thor's pissed. He doesn't see any fear in my eyes. He hollers something unintelligible over the wind, raises a fist in the direction of his buddies. Watching Thor has distracted her. Her foot drifts down on the accelerator, defaulting to habit. The escape rockets up to 90 right as one of Thor's buddies swerves to cut her off. Almost gracefully, the man's body flies upward onto the hood, then crashes into her windshield, leaving a mosaic of cracks. When he flips up and away, going over the roof with a sound like tumbling boulders, she sees the blacktop has been replaced by open desert. She tries to regain control, but the steering wheel's been pulled almost entirely apart. The ring cracked on top and bottom. A bulge of wires protrudes from a mouth-like fold where the horn should be. No way could the biker's impact have done this. She did it while holding on to the thing for dear life during the collision. The escape slams into a saguaro cactus with such force the hood flips up and turns into something that looks like a wadded-up napkin. Only then does she realize she never put her seatbelt on, but it doesn't matter. She experiences the impact like a kid being jostled by her friends in a bouncy house. She can see everything with the slow-motion clarity of shock. The shattering windshield, the Beretta going airborne and disappearing out the passenger side window. And then it all comes to an end. Even though she should be either unconscious or dead, she's sitting upright behind the wheel, her breathing rapid but barely strained. There's a loud thud. The escape's roof gives her scalp a sudden kiss. The top half of the giant cactus has fallen onto her hissing SUV. She feels as if she's belly-flopped into a swimming pool. The car crash has left her with a rash of tingles across her flesh and dull aches here and there. But it should be worse, much worse, given the state of the car and the fact she was bounced around like a rag doll. The music in her bones has grown more intense, as if the trauma of the accident kicked up the tempo. Whatever this thing is that's happening to her, it's hooked to adrenaline. But that can't be the only explanation. She gives the door a push, and the entire thing comes free of its hinges and falls to the sand. As they roar toward her through the darkness, the two remaining bikers make hairpin turns around rocks, bushes, and other knee-high obstructions. They're coming with predatory fury. Thor pulls around to her right. His friend dismounts at her left and draws a sawed-off shotgun from his back. Her ears still ring from the crash, but she can hear some of their shouts. They're gesturing to their feet, gesturing for her to get down either to her knees or her stomach. They don't seem to care which. The words bitch and cunt jump out at her from their threats like hot pebbles glancing across her cheeks. She feels as though she's observing herself from a distance, and she's astonished to watch herself sink to her knees, just as her foot defaulted back to its normal pressure on the gas pedal moments before. She now defaults to fear and submission. But it's a big shotgun, and she doesn't know if this altered state renders her impervious to buckshot. Then she sees the flex cuffs in Thor's left hand. In his right, he's got a gun. Moxie enough to be a Kanak TP-9, but she's not sure. She is sure that he's aiming at her, lowering it only slightly as he approaches. He's going to cuff her out